You're listening to a Times Higher Education podcast.
Hello and welcome to this Times Higher Education issue review podcast for the edition covering the 31st of October to the 6th of November 2013. My name is Chris Parr. I'm joined by editor John Gill, deputy news editor John Morgan and reporter David Matthews. In today's podcast, we'll hear about a Times Higher Education survey looking at the number of Indian postgraduate applications to UK universities. We'll be looking at students who've been found guilty of cheating at a UK university's Dubai campus. John Gill has been asking VCs what they feel the government's HE priorities should be in the build-up to the next general election. And I also spoke earlier today to Matthew Rice, who penned this week's cover feature, which is an illuminating interview with Lynn Segal, anniversary professor of psychology and gender studies, at Birkbeck University of London. But we start with this week's splash, John Morgan, in which you carried out a survey of the number of Indian postgraduate students applying to UK universities.
Yes, so I surveyed about 20 universities on their applications from non-EU students for 2013-14. The bad news was, as you say, on Indian postgraduates, that's down on average 8% across those universities, which compares with the 6% rise in postgraduate applications from China, which is the other key overseas market for British universities. And within that, you can see some big falls in Indian postgraduate applications, even at some very prestigious universities with global reputations. So Exeter's down about 27%, Edinburgh down 28%, King's College London down 16%. So that's quite a worrying pattern in an essential market for British universities. And obviously this comes in the wake of continued tightening of the student visa regime by the government, and the fact that the immigration crackdown is one of the government's key policy priorities, and it will continue to have an effect, one will think, will sort of heighten concerns about what will happen with Indian student numbers in the future.
I think one of the things that struck me about this story was that, as you point out in the piece, John, you're actually talking about application numbers rather than actual numbers through the door. So these students that still have to go and get visas, and but I suppose in the context of people coming here with firm offers from prestigious universities for postgraduate degrees, that probably won't be an issue. I suppose the big problem for in India in particular, or the big turn off for many Indian students, is the post-study work visa restrictions, or the fact that they perhaps won't have the freedom to work here after they finish studying that they once did. Although, to be fair to Vince Cable and David Willetts, there have been some concessions on this, haven't there? So at PhD level now, it's certainly easier to stay. And Vince Cable at the Universities UK conference was hinting that there might be some scope for that being rolled out further down the scale at postgraduate too, so perhaps you'd be able to stay on if you did a master's or something like that. So what's the current situation as far as that's concerned?
So the post-study route was closed in April 2012, and so now students who want to stay on for work have to qualify through the employment visa route and have to have an offer of a job that pays above £20,000 a year, so a kind of graduate level job, but as you say, it's sort of a measure of the seriousness that Biz is taking this, that Cable's sort of signalled that he wants to really shake up the post-study work situation and open it up more, because as you say, it's seen as a crucial factor that's deterring Indian students.
On the other hand, I mean, this has clearly impacted India quite a lot. There's been a lot of bad messages going out to the Indian press about, you know, British universities being sort of closed for business. However, if you're sort of looking at these figures in the government, you might think, has the sector kind of overplayed its hand a little bit? Because Chinese students, basically, the big rise in those, and they've essentially offset, you know, those coming from India. And if the visa restrictions are so bad, why aren't Chinese students...
Part of the evolution of the student body as well. Yes, India's down, China's... things change.
There's certainly cultural sensitivities in India that don't exist in other countries, or less pronounced in other countries. Yeah. And this is the first story I've seen of yours, John, where you actually quote people who are kind of suggesting just what David did, that actually perhaps the sector has slightly over-egged the pudding.
Yeah, so that's that's the Indian figures were the bad side of the picture. The positive side of the picture that I found in the survey was that overall applications, particularly undergraduate applications from non-EU students, they were up 8.8%, and for postgraduates the rise was 8.9%. So, and as you say, I've got quotes from Bill Rammels saying that the fact that figures have held up reinforces the need for all universities not to exaggerate the impact of government policy, and Sean Curtis, International Director at Exeter, saying that there's no need for a repeat of the siren voices that anticipated a negative impact some years ago, and he's making the point that the Indian situation is down to how the Indian press have reported the visa changes, and that's quite a, as you were suggesting, David, it's probably quite a unique situation that the government certainly would say doesn't reflect the fuller picture of what's happened.
And that actually ties, doesn't it, to another piece we have in this week's magazine, in which David's looked at just this issue, and you've got people feeling quite bullish, actually, about the future of student flow from India.
Yeah, so I spoke to Harjit Singh, who's the founder of Brain Gain magazine, which is for students from South Asia who want to study abroad, basically. And he was saying, well, you know, we've had some big drops in the number of Indian students coming to the UK recently, but in the broad scheme of things, this number is going to go up and up and up in future years. This is kind of a blip, and the reason for that is just simply that there is just so much demand in India. You know, he kept telling me, "Don't worry, don't worry." There's still this demand there, and also the other question in India as well, which perhaps isn't talked about quite enough, which is the question of finance. You know, more and more Indian families can afford to send their children abroad because you're getting increased availability of bank loans that just wasn't there, you know, 20 years ago. He said when he went to study in the States in 1990, all he could take out of India was $500. Mm. But now it's a lot easier to get this money, and also the Indian government is really pressing for banks to make loans more easily available.
I don't know if I'd ever really twigged that the people are effectively taking mortgages out, are they, to pay their overseas tuition fees? So families, it's not a question of families saving, and, you know, grandparents saving
as well. But if you can get, you know, the sort of middle class families rather than the super rich, but I mean, presumably they'll be taking up loans rather than funding it all from savings. Yeah, it's very much loans based.
So David Willett says to UK students, it's not credit card debt. In the case of Indian students, it probably is.
Different countries' credit cards.
That's also the reason why Indian students are so attached to working post study, and why the closure of the post study work route was so bad, particularly for them, is because they take out private loans to fund their studies, so they have to find work to start repaying the loan. So all these issues are linked.
Catch 22.
Interesting stuff.
Well, of course, another way that UK universities target the purse strings of overseas students is with campuses overseas. And David, it's back to you again, I'm afraid. Yes, you're busy in this podcast. You've been writing about a UK university's Dubai campus and some allegations of cheating there. Well, more than allegations. People have been found guilty. What's the story?
Yes, this is about Heriot Watt University's campus in Dubai, which is one of the biggest over there and is, you know, pretty significant part of Dubai's kind of education city, kind of attempt to attract foreign universities to the Emirates. And we found in some of their council minutes some pretty surprising figures about academic misconduct on that campus. So in 2011-12, about one in eight students in a particular school, the School of Management and Languages, were found to have basically been caught cheating, essentially. And there's a kind of discussion in the university about this in the Senate, which partly put this down to low entry standards. And what's emerged is that the entry standards, it seems, in the Dubai campus were quite a bit lower than they were on Heriot Watt's campus in Scotland. And I suppose there's a bigger debate here about how comparable, you know, branch campuses have to be with their kind of, you know, the sort of mothership, as it were, in the UK.
Yeah, well, we should make it clear it's not just Heriot Watt that has campuses over there. And I imagine if you did a bit of digging around, you might find similar stories elsewhere. But it does, beg the question, how do you monitor standards? How do you monitor intake of students when it's so far away? I mean, do they have pretty sophisticated systems in place, or are they just, yeah, as you sort of alluded to there, they just have lowering entry requirements because that's the market.
Supply and demand, basically. I mean, that was one of their explanations. I mean, what they're implying is there's far more demand to go to Heriot Watt in Scotland rather than Dubai, and therefore they can have a higher entry tariff when people go to Scotland. I mean, they did say that there's a sort of minimum that applies across all of the campuses. But, you know, I mean, is that right? I mean, you know, UK universities say that their branch campuses, you know, have a equivalent academic experience and everyone's tested the same standards. But if people don't have the same grades between the two campuses, you know, they're not quite the same.
It's one of those things that's always said, and I'm sure people, you know, say it with the best of intentions, but there's always a slight shifty look in people's eye when they tell you that. You do wonder to what extent it can truly be an equivalent. It certainly can't be an equivalent experience, can it? No. I mean, anyone that's been to one of these campuses, they feel very different. You know, the number of students there and so on is very different from your home campus in the UK. I mean, one of the things I found striking about your story, David, was that you finish up with a quote from Heriot Watt saying that, pointing out that their branch campus in Dubai is one of the largest in the country and has amongst the highest entry standards in the Emirates too. So if they're suffering this level of cheating, it does beg the question, you know, are some of those with lower entry standards suffering even worse? Yeah. Which will be interesting to know.
Exactly. Absolutely. Well, John, slightly closer to home, your editorial this week is centred on a straw poll that you did, I believe, of VCs, sort of looking at what their priorities are in terms of
HE. Yeah, I'm very unscientific.
Well, that's why we use the phrase straw poll, isn't it? Generally means it's, you know, it is what it is.
We now know that David Willetts, you know, barring some extraordinary turn of events, is likely to be in his post as the Universities and Science Minister until he'll see the Parliament out, so that's, what, another 18 months?
Mm-hmm.
Maybe slightly more than that. And it just seems to me that it is a bit of a transition for David Willetts too, because he might look at the job and say, well, look, a lot of the heavy lifting's been done now as far as fees reform is concerned. There probably isn't the appetite on behalf of either the Conservative Party or their Liberal Democrat partners, or in truth, Labour, to talk about anything too controversial in higher education policy terms in the run-up to the election, after the Lib Dems had such a painful experience last time with their fees pledge. There's also the fact that David Willetts' right-hand man, Nick Hillman, is about to step down as his special advisor and move to HEPI. So there's a whole bunch of things changing, and you could potentially see a situation where stuff goes quiet on the policy front. But actually, I think there's an awful lot of... I mean, you just have to read our news pages to see all the issues that universities are still grappling with. So I just asked a few vice-chancellors for their views on what the priorities they would like to see David Willetts set for the next 18 months to ensure that, you know, important issues are addressed where they need to be. And it's a fairly predictable list, perhaps, but funding really is the number one concern. Every single vice-chancellor that responded was worried about the state of funding. Mm. The fact that the 9K fee level is a hard cap, and, you know, with inflation year on year, it's going to slowly erode. A lot of worry about the fact that it isn't a stable system, may not long-term be a system that can be maintained with the RAB charge being as high as it is. So all those issues that we've talked about in terms of funding week in, week out, and certainly I think they want, a lot of vice-chancellors felt that there was a very strong need for David Willetts to at the very least confirm that the fees cap wouldn't be reduced after the election. A lot of concern about Labour's mooted 6K fee cap and what that could mean for their bottom line. But it's not just funding. There was also concern about the postgraduate funding issues, the fact that there isn't a coherent system for postgrads, the fact that visa policies, as we've discussed earlier, still very high on their agenda. Several vice-chancellors talked about the erosion of teacher training in universities, which for those that, you know, do teacher training is a really big deal, and perhaps one of those slightly unsexy issues that doesn't get the focus it needs at the higher education level. The RAF, obviously, I mean, we're talking in the week of the census date for the RAF. So a lot of concern about how that will play out. And one vice chancellor at a new university did say to me that he really hoped David Willetts would oversee an RAF that genuinely rewards decent research wherever it's found. It incentivises, not punishes, the two-star work where evident improvement is shown since 2008. So these are just some of the issues that are really being thought about. But above all, I think what the Vice-Chancellor said they needed was stability. I think we've had such a turbulent few years that they really need a period where they can sit down, understand what the ground rules are, understand the pitch they're playing on, and really sort of set things up so that their universities can prosper in the next 18 months and not be struck by the kind of ructions that they've had in recent months and years.
Yeah, stability except fees, not stable, but going upwards.
Stability where they want to be, yeah. But yeah, exactly. Certain areas need addressing. Yeah, well, in the build-up to an election, I guess good luck with any wishes for stability. But an insightful read, nonetheless, on page 5 this week. Before we move on, I should flag up a separate dedicated books podcast we have coming out tomorrow. That's November the 1st. Karen Shook, our books editor, speaks to Angus Deaton, not the erstwhile Have I Got News For You presenter, but the economics professor, who talks about his new book, The Great Escape, Health, Wealth and Origins of Inequality, alongside a number of other issues as well, I'm sure. They are pretty thorough interviews, though, so you should definitely check out that series. But for now, we'll leave you there. But I did speak earlier to Matthew Rice, who, as I said earlier, penned this week's cover feature, and here he tells us a little bit more about it. So Matthew, our cover this week features a very striking image of Lynn Segal, anniversary professor of psychology and gender studies at Birkbeck University of London. Perhaps you could start by telling us, well, why this was the time to interview her and why you wanted to speak with her.
Well, she's a very intriguing character. She's part of the generation of 1970s feminist academics. And she told me that the demands on academics' time were rather less when she was younger. So she was very much an activist, a journalist, and an academic all the same time, involved in a lot of feminist causes, wrote a lot of very celebrated books at the time. So very much part of a movement which has clearly had a major impact on British higher education and indeed British life. And she is now kind of retirement age, and she wanted to think about ageing. And so she's written this long book about ageing, looking back at her experiences as a radical and the generation of radicals that she worked with and the younger generation of radicals, and looking at both the challenges and the pleasures and the complexity of ageing. Mm. And I think one of the things she says is when she was younger, there was among her peers, there was a big thing about they used to make jokes about songs like Keep Young and Beautiful If You Want to Be Loved. And it was very good fun to make fun of that sort of thing. But of course, when one is young and beautiful people, it's less of a problem. And then age, the whole issue of ageing and whether people still find you desirable anymore and whether people take you seriously anymore, and how you can maintain links with the kind of radicalism of your past, even though other radical ideas have come through. All these issues she reflects on very amusingly and touchingly in the book and indeed in the interview I did with her.
I noticed one thing in that interview. She said that PhD students often want her to supervise them. Curious about a time when things seemed more possible, she describes it. It strikes me that this interview and the book itself could be a little bit of a depressing read. Lots of looking back, lots of looking back with rose-tinted spectacles, as it were. Is that the sense you've got, or is there more to it?
Well, I think she's very positive about all the movements she was involved with, but also suitably amused and ironic about them as well. But, I mean, as she says, PhD students, to some extent, seek out their supervisors rather than the other way around. And so the fact that she was involved in certain radical causes and that people are still interested and still want to hear from her is clearly something positive. Times are clearly different, and as a sort of left-leaning feminist, very active in the cause of Israel-Palestine and so on, there are a lot of aspects of the world which seem rather depressing, but she still thinks it's worth fighting and worth drawing on the past, but also accepting that things are different now and one has to do different things.
Absolutely. Well, a fascinating read. Some revealing quotes in there as well about Professor Segal's past life, but maybe we should leave that off the podcast and encourage our listeners to make sure they read that interview in full.
Indeed.
Very good. Well, if you have heard anything on the podcast that you wish to comment about, you can reach us via all the usual means. We're on Facebook, we're on LinkedIn, we're on Google+, we're on Twitter at Times Higher Ed as well. But until next week, that's the end of the Times Higher Education Issue Review Podcast.
You're listening to a Times Higher Education podcast.